In a mostly unknown corner of the 1980s world, a noetic scientist was documenting cases of spontaneous remission. 10,000 of them. To this day, this research remains largely unknown. Yes, most of us are aware of the suppression around medical alternatives and phenomena, but at that time, there just were not many people there to acknowledge something simply unknown. As we move into part two today with Dr. William Kautz, we'll get a bit more of the picture as Bill was a pioneer who began bringing intuition out of the pseudoscience closet in the early 1950s. He continues to draw information from that unseen realm, opening more and more doors to perception. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
I think the best evidence we got, though, Robin, was in the area of earthquakes. So if you'd like to hear about that,
yes, that sounds great.
Back in the late 70s, there was just no understanding of the short-term cause of earthquakes. That is what triggers them off at all. Seismologists had cataloged that earthquakes had occurred thanks to the seismograph, and they mapped the Earth both interior and surface for where how earthquakes are happening, but they had nothing at all to go on for what's happening at the last minute, and therefore what might enable us to predict them. Because, you know, to predict an earthquake as being possibly likely in 20 years is no help at all for saving lives and for protecting property. You need to have a prediction that's, say, within 1 month of it's happening before you can take any action, like protecting people. So we decided to take an intuitive look at this question. What are the most important and possibly useful premonitors of earthquakes that might be instrumented physically to help with short-term prediction? We weren't trying to predict earthquakes per se, you know, like some particular earthquake. We were just asking for the geophysical mechanism behind earthquake occurrences. Well, we got a load of information on this and eventually generated a list of about 12 different possible premonitors that could be used, each having different characteristics. And we've through this before the geophysical community, and not surprisingly, they were not at all interested. Because the ideas were not good, they may have been, but they were overwhelmed with the problem using their own approaches. You know, they were looking at the ground. Maybe it lifts up a few inches just before an earthquake. Or maybe there's radon or gases appearing in well water and so forth, which they were just beginning to check. But they were not interested in the sort of things we were coming up with, which, according to the intuitives, earthquakes are triggered by a much grander process that goes off into mainly the atmosphere and even the ionosphere and outer space. Now, this was pretty far out. How could earthquakes possibly be caused or even monitored by what's going on in the atmosphere and the ionosphere? This is just too much. So they disregarded it. We published this in a paper in an obscure journal of our findings.
What journal was it?
Oh, it was called Psychic Exploration or something like that. It's defunct now. It died many decades ago.
Sure.
But we published it and forgot about it. You know, we decided this is not going to go anywhere. But then in the mid-80s, something started to happen. Satellites went up and started monitoring the Earth from space. And what did they discover? many things, but one of them was that in the vicinity of earthquakes, the ground is getting hotter. There's electromagnetic radiations coming out of the ground. The ionosphere is moving up and down. And several things like this. Well, we were very pleased, of course, because what the intuitives came up with was being vindicated.
Sure.
Since 1980 and 2000, a lot more research of this sort has come out. It's become very credible. A couple of satellites have gone up just for the purpose of looking for earthquakes. So we prepared a paper, as we did the bipolar paper in 2012, to report this and report the successes that the intuitives have.
Oh, bravo.
Yeah, pretty convincing. this is published in Journal for Scientific Exploration.
I can just see you with a little grin on your face.
Yeah, it was.
You know, I also read, you know, in describing appropriate therapies for treating HIV and AIDS as a research project. But the other part of that I thought was quite interesting about what can be learned from the presence of this disease in the world today. What did your intuitives come up with regarding that?
Well, apart from the technology and scientific understanding, there is a big question. How come this mysterious, perplexing, and impactful disease has come upon humanity at this particular point? You know, is it all just a big accident, or have we somehow produced it?
Did intuitives feel like it was a man-made disease?
Well, no, not in the sense of which you probably think the question. It arose naturally out of Africa, and then went through different stages of development before it got into the form that we now call AIDS. That is a particular type of HIV virus. But it's man-made in the sense that it turns out, according to the intuitives, to be a rather simple virus, and it's easily handled by the body within a matter of days if the body's healthy. But the problem is, bodies these days are not usually very healthy. And in particular, the first groups of people who were being afflicted with AIDS were certainly not healthy. These were gays in New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, who were living pretty wild lives, you know. They were drinking a lot, taking drugs, and their immune systems were not exactly dead, but they were very well depressed.
Yes.
That, in fact, is a more accurate description of the cause of AIDS than saying it's a virus, because the virus, it turns out to be something that isn't that powerful. It's just that if it has a chance to get into the body, it can cause havoc. So, you see, we're playing a game with the term cause, with the word cause here, but it does seem to be more fair to say that the cause of AIDS is not the virus, really, but preparation of the body to maintain, or the lack of preparation of the body to maintain a healthy immune system.
Certainly, that was the whole premise of Dr. Otto Warburg, who is the only man to ever have won the Nobel Prize for Medicine 2 times, and actually he was nominated a 3rd time. And he applied his knowledge into stating that it was the lack of oxygen at a cellular level. And of course, there are a million reasons why that can become the state in a human body, but if you want to go to a base, there it is.
Yeah, that's right. But the funny thing about it is that the medical system is not comfortable with immunity, especially psychoneuroimmunology, which is a very tiny fraction of medicine. It's never been deeply explored. It sounds too mental, you see, and not, doesn't fall within medicine. So when they were looking for what to do about AIDS, the first thing they came up with was this militaristic approach, is let's kill the virus. Hooray, we found a virus. Our task is to kill it. But this set in motion the whole medical, social, and even political drama that took place in the first decade of dealing with AIDS.
Right.
It got such a momentum that other considerations, such as psychoimmunology, never even had a chance to have their voice heard.
Right. I was just thinking there's a reality TV show, I think, I don't keep up with them, on TV in the U.S. called The Fear Factor, and that would have made a great show. The Fear Factor, everyone's thrown into a tizzy with this AIDS thing, and dun-dun-dun-dun. Anyway, I'm being silly because...
Certainly, fear is certainly, if you want to look for a basic component of what's the cause of AIDS, that's where you find it, certainly.
Yes.
What happens, people get just the very idea of catching AIDS and dying painfully and early puts people into a panic, right?
Yes, of
Their
course.
Their response to this situation is to take certain steps which actually help to helps to provoke the disease in them instead of prevent it.
Yes. More recently, you've been interviewing folks who share how they've benefited from intense suffering and being in a lot of pain in their lives. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about that.
Well, I'd be glad to. This is an idea to create an anthology of reports from heavy sufferers, not about the suffering they went through, but rather about what they learned or gained from having to go through that suffering. I was shocked to discover that nobody's ever done this, you know. How are we supposed to learn about suffering and how to deal with it if we don't listen to people who are suffering, for heaven's sakes, who have suffered?
Well, and, that's the fear right there.
You betcha. So I've had a lot of tragic fun in collecting these accounts from people and selecting those where the situation was described very eloquently and compassionately and in a way that might be useful to others. So I've got about a dozen of them now that appear to be workable, and I'm putting those into a book to be appear early next year.
I certainly know many folks who have had cancer and feel like it was the greatest gift.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's largely the feeling that there was something going on, and these people realized that, these sufferers realized that there was something going on in their life which could best be handled by a suffering experience. It's like they were putting up resistance to something that was trying to happen in their lives, and they were objective to it. They didn't want to go along with it. It could be something as simple as a psychological rebellion against the world or against the other people, some kind of deep resentments or just lack of compassion for themselves and for other people. But it could also be more subtle. And what they realized as a result of their suffering, which put them into a very special mental state to deal with the pain, they began to realize what it was that they were doing in their resistance. And in the best cases, of course, they healed from that. They, with that realization, they stopped doing the negative thing and came out on top. So those are the kind of stories I want to report. So basically, resistance was the key factor, and it resistance came from fear.
I know. It's so interesting, isn't it, that it's never the issue of whatever they're resisting. It becomes simply the fact that there's the resistance going on. And it doesn't mean you have to give in to everything. It just means there needs to be a little subtle shift from the initial get-go, and then things can work out.
Yeah, well, that's so true. And that subtle shift is, you know, it doesn't have to be subtle. It could be right out in front of you.
Right, yes, yes, certainly. Before we move into another topic with you, I want to share something. I was up the other morning at 3 a.m. And I had gotten this email, and I don't really care, especially in this moment right now, about UFOs or aliens or anything like that, but this was a supposed interview with a real alien, and the person that was talking about this in the video was saying how when the aliens were trying to describe to our hottest scientists about their technology, there were two things that stood out. One was there was a large turnover in these scientists because it basically fried their brains. The technology was so far beyond what they were aware of with their knowledge of physics and things that they couldn't even go there. So it just basically burned them out. The other thing the person brought up, which I think relates to where we're going right now, is that they said that these aliens really spoke more from a spiritual place. The technology all fit in, but their way of talking about it was so much more spiritual. And I think it was coming from that more intuitive place. They had such a clearer depth of things that they weren't getting caught up in all the emotional and the mental and the reasoning and all of these things, which is a place where humanity seems to be and gradually working our way out, I believe. But
well, it certainly ties in, Robin. They, just like with AIDS, we as a humanity are being awoken each day to something bigger than we thought was there. And UFOs, such things are certainly part of it. We don't know exactly what it is, but whatever it is, it's having its effect. And crop circles, you know, how could this happen? Well, it's in front of, I don't know about scientists having their minds blown. It's just that they don't know how to handle it.
Right. And,
it doesn't fit into the sort of their model of how the world works, which is basically just materialistic. And it doesn't fit into the kinds of things they know how to study. And they don't even have a good means for verifying what's happening.
Well, I think it offers them a solid future. They're going to find out little bits and pieces along the way, and then they will be able to have a way to describe and understand, etc. You know, there are two things I want to talk with you for sure before we finish today. One of them is in your email to me, you wrote that there's a new science emerging that shows hope for embracing subjective and mind-based phenomena in future decades, which is a project of yours, and also your book, The Pre-Christian Jesus, an intuitive anthology. So I don't know which of those is more appropriate to start first, but I'll leave that to you.
Okay, well, let's start with Jesus, since it's a half a second fresher. One thing you can use intuitive consensus for is to recover lost history. That means, in effect, what happened but was never recorded as history. You know, most of what's gone on in the past, there's no record of it. And this holds particularly for the life and teachings of Jesus. For he was taken over by the early Christian church early on, and the description of his life and the teachings he was offering were changed and adapted to what the early Christians wanted to create. And we are left in the dark about what really happened. So we used intuitive consensus to try to regenerate the life of the pre-Christian Jesus. And we relied mostly on material that was already published but was very obscure and not known publicly. And this we put together into a book published last year called The Story of Jesus. It's coming out again with the name The Pre-Christian Jesus. to present this. And I think a lot of people are going to be interested in this because there's a general discontent among Christians that the religion that they adhere to, for so long, is somehow not quite up to the job of taking care of them and inspiring them in their lives. It does something, but the potential is so much greater than what is being manifested in contemporary religion. And this is not just Christianity, it's other religions in the world as well.
Of course.
It's time for change, you see. Now, on the other topic which you mentioned of new science, science is under pressure now to go through a major change, a major shift in the way it works with reality and reflects it back to the world. This is because, on one hand, it's confronted with so many problems it cannot solve. It's becoming aware of these. And it's under pressure, we might say, to solve these problems. But at the same time, it's strongly limited by a set of what are called metaphysical assumptions about the reality, about the world, which it has operated under ever since the 17th century. These assumptions do not allow it to deal with subjective material, because objectivity is fundamental to science. Also fundamental is several other similar assumptions about the nature of causality, about things having to be measurable, and so on. So, because of these pressures and this opportunity, science is having to find a way out of this bind that it's in, to stay objective. It just isn't working anymore. Somebody is looking for ways in which subjectivity might be incorporated into science. The changes that are implied in science are so great that maybe you can't even call it science anymore. But at least some kind of a new social institution is beginning to emerge for dealing with these mainly subjective phenomena, the human mind.
Can you give an example of the subjectivity that would perhaps lead us into this new science or?
Yes, look at these basic experiments that are done in fundamental particle physics, quantum physics. You know, the human mind has been discovered to be a factor in that. The intention of the observer of these experiments is affecting the way they turn out. And it turns out you can't even tell what's going on until it's observed, for heaven's sake. There is no event taking place until the observation happens. So this is certainly subjective. The mind is inherently involved in fundamental physics, but it's also involved in the rest of human life. And the way experiments turn out, not only in medicine and biology, but in sociology, human behavior are strongly dependent upon the human mind. And how, you can't even study these things with science, right? It doesn't have the tools. Everybody's faced with it. The placebo effect, for example.
The what effects?
Placebo effect.
Yes.
When you give people placebos that are supposed to improve a physical condition, the placebos work almost as well as the treatment you're giving. This isn't supposed to happen, but it does. It's very embarrassing to medical scientists that this is going on. So for the most part, they neglect it. Spontaneous remissions of disease. A colleague back in Institute of Noetic Sciences back in the early 80s did a study of spontaneous remission and documented 10,000 cases in which diseases cured themselves, that is, they just suddenly have disappeared without any medical treatment at all, and often in spite of them. So, if it's that important, why isn't anybody paying attention to it? And they aren't, you know, because they don't know how to handle it.
Right.
It's not important. Uh-huh. Well, there's a few examples. What is driving Western world to form a new kind of science for studying the world.
Right. What do you think, Bill, has been most important for you in, I feel like you've gone through this very natural progression of using and being intuitive. What do you think helps you the most in order to be the most intuitive? I'm sure you live your life there.
Well, I never claimed that I was a good intuitive.
No, I know. We're not saying that.
I have my own way of being intuitive, and it's personally extremely meaningful to me. I can't imagine living without it now, but it's not something I want to lay out in the world as a big accomplishment. I think there are expert intuitives who do this much better and more practically and universally than I could do. But what is most important to me was understanding that human life and the living of it is a much richer and fundamentally and spiritually oriented activity than I ever imagined. I call it spiritual with that one particular meaning of the term, not as religious, but as a statement of the fundamental drive for people to answer the underlying questions of who am I and why am I here trying to live a life? And what in the world am I supposed to be doing? Where do I find meaning in what's going on? And, of course, what's going to happen to me after I leave this life? These are spiritual questions. And that's really almost entirely what spirituality is the dealing with these issues and their immediate application. It's not all this dogmatic and doctrinaire stuff that most religions have been forced to come up with to gain their popularity and effect.
It's a common occurrence today, being able to really be aware of our own intuition, but many thanks to Dr. William Kautz for helping to bring it out into our world. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And on iTunes for podcasting, it's Tributaries Radio. You can leave any comments you like at either of those places, so be great to hear from any of you. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.